Well, it's been a long time, KP2. We haven't talked, we haven't done a podcast or a D'Antonio Wingcast in what, like 2 or 3 weeks, but we're back. We're going to do an epic two-part, roughly 2 hour long, super duper the D'Antonio Wingcast. Your book's out. It's on Amazon.com. You're all the way up to fourth on the basketball books chart. I'm pretty sure that this podcast is the sole reason, or the number one reason, along with Blazers Edge, that you're that high. Would you agree, disagree, or are you just too busy counting your money?
I think it's the main reason. I wouldn't say it's the sole reason, but yeah, we definitely saw a spike right after you mentioned that we had gotten on Amazon. So clearly, Blazers Edge readers, we thank you guys, and we owe you a lot of our support. As far as the Wingcast, I did try to demand an emergency impromptu Wingcast last week because Ben was taking shots at Nate McMillan, the player, and the success of the 1996 Sonics in the NBA Finals last week. But since we couldn't get that worked out, we decided to save everything up and just combine it into one massive podcast this week that should just fill your brain for years. There's going to be so much information over the next, couple hours.
Hey, real quick, does it get awkward when LaMarcus Aldridge asks to borrow money from you after all these book sales? I mean, is it weird? I mean, because like when I'm driving down the road and there's guys on the side of the road asking me for money, I feel bad. A lot of times I'll, give out some change if it's a Vietnam vet or if it's another, veteran of the war. Is it weird when a professional basketball player starts coming to you for dough because you just wrote such a ridiculously awesome book? I mean, is that, I mean, does he violate some sort of core principles of journalism by doing that, or how do you handle that situation?
Well, I've told him that now that he's signed a $65 million extension, that really it just doesn't make any sense anymore, that I'm going to have to start collecting on all of those, start treating them as loans.
Oh, so you're applying interest, so a chunk of, so he better not get any technical fouls because the league is going to be taking the money that should be going to you. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean that extension doesn't kick in until next year, so he's making a paltry, I don't know what, $5, $6 million this year. He can barely afford it at this point.
Oh boy. Well, no wonder he doesn't have any crazy rims on his car like Travis Outlaw. By the way, Travis Outlaw has spent a higher ratio of his contract on rims than any other Blazer, and it's not even close. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if he spent like 150% of his contract on rims. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if the rim dealer is really hoping that Travis gets paid out of this world so he can make even more money, because Travis has just the most ridiculous rims on every single one of his vehicles. Apparently that he's in Dime Magazine. I didn't know this. I haven't seen it yet, but apparently he's got a whole whips spread in Dime Magazine. But LA is not like that, and now we know why. It's because he's busy borrowing money from Kevin Pelton, the writer. So how does it feel to have a book that's number 4 on the basketball charts on
Yeah.
Amazon.com? Is that a pretty good feeling or what?
I can't lie. It's been exciting. It's been a fun ride. We've gotten a lot of very positive feedback on it. Bethlehem Scholes' review on Free Darko was very, very kind to us, and other people have had nice things to say. It's gratifying because, I mean, the weird thing about I'm the kind of writer who I'm obsessively in need of feedback. I crave it all the time, and it kills me, like, when a column of mine doesn't get posted for a day or two that someone sits on it. So to try to write this book and not have it come out for months later, and it just, you're plagued with self-doubt, and you're like, are people going to like this? Is it going to be terrible? Maybe we don't have a professional editor. It could be just completely awful and destroy my career or something like that. So it's nice that people have been positive, and if they're just saying that to be nice to me, then I appreciate that nonetheless.
Wow, you just sounded like a complete psycho right there. But that's cool. No, everything's cool. Everything's
Wait,
cool,
wait,
dude.
no, in my defense, I asked Nathaniel, I asked Bethlehem, I should say, if I was checking the Amazon page falsely, because it was like once every 2 hours, and he said that he checked his way more often than that, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, you kind of have to do that. I do have a problem, though, and it's a problem that we've addressed, or I've addressed on the site and also on Twitter, but I'm going to address it right now to make this podcast super awkward. What was up with the hyphenation of my name in the acknowledgments? Not only did I let you know that this was going to be an issue before you finally printed the hardcover version, but you completely ignored my pleas to just rearrange the names a little bit so that I wasn't the one to get hyphenated. I'll have you know I put in hours editing this book, hours of psychological assistance, making sure you didn't go completely off the rails throughout, the last 2 months, and you're going to hit me with a hyphen like that? That hurts, KP. That hurts a lot. That goes straight to my soul.
Well, as Casey pointed out on Twitter, it's really just a creative way of creating a new nickname for you. That's all we were trying to do at the end. And Benjamin Goliver, I don't know how you pronounce the last name of that, is probably about the best nickname you're ever going to get.
So what you're telling me is when the prospectus comes out next year, you're going to purposely hyphenate me again? Is that what I do? I have a lifetime of hyphens to look forward to here. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, I know we're going to hyphenate the last name too, just for fun.
Jeez Louise. Absolutely no respect. Now I know how LaMarcus Aldridge feels, and this is a perfect segue. Brilliant how I did that. The underappreciated, often disrespected, often overlooked LaMarcus Aldridge, the Blazers' number two option, just inked, officially announced today, his 5-year, $65 million plus potential incentives, pushing it to $70 million extension that will kick in next year. So basically, he got locked down. He's going to be a Blazer for a long time. He's right behind Brandon Roy. He didn't quite get Brandon Roy money, but I don't think he deserved it. I don't think anyone, including LaMarcus, thought he deserved it, but he definitely got paid. You had to call him up today, actually, this morning, talking about how that contract size compares to some other guys out there, recent extensions. Did the Blazers get a good deal? Did LA get a good deal? What happened here?
Yeah, I think the conclusion I eventually came to was that it was a pretty fair deal for both sides. I think that there probably was a demand from Aldridge and his agent at the beginning to try to get a max contract because, in theory, he's a good enough player that, you can at least make the argument that he deserves to be there. Now, that doesn't mean he's as good as Brandon, which, nobody can argue, I don't think. But the way that max contracts were handed out such times in the past, I mean, you've seen guys like him get a lot of money. But on the balance, when you look at, what extensions players who have had similar value over their first 3 years have gotten, LaMarcus is towards the higher end of that range, and not egregiously so, and especially when you consider the fact that he's fairly young for a third-year player because he only spent 2 years in college. So he's the same age and similar production as guys like Lamar Odom, Andrew Bogut, Andre Iguodala, guys like that, who are, in Iguodala's case, probably going to take that step to All-Star in the next couple of years here. Mike Bibby was another one in that group who never quite got to All-Star level, but was probably the best player not to make an All-Star team for a while in the middle part of the decade. So guys who are not unfair comparisons to Aldridge, and they got deals that started out at about $10 million a year, so maybe a tiny bit less than the $10.7 million that Aldridge will make next year, but not enough to make this a bad deal for the Blazers. I think this is one that everybody can go home feeling happy about.
You know what's interesting? I was talking to Kevin Pritchard today after the announcement, and you might remember back in the summer when he announced Brandon Roy's contract extension. He had a very clear challenge to Brandon after the deal was done, basically saying, "What kind of a player do you want to become? What kind of destiny do you want to write for yourself?" And I asked him if he had the same kind of questions for LaMarcus, and his answer surprised me. He said, "You know what? Frankly, the deal got done so quickly at the end of it that I haven't even had a time to sit down and talk to LaMarcus about expectations, to talk to LaMarcus about the next step." So that kind of caught me off guard because it was obviously a drawn-out negotiations. It almost went right down to the deadline. I mean, they have what, less than a week or roughly a week before the deadline to have gotten that deal done. But it sounds like it was sort of a late-breaking, quick-developing final negotiations that actually got everything in place. And you wonder, what do you think prompted that? I almost think that maybe, LA and his side capitulated a little bit and realized, hey, you know what? This deal is a pretty darn good deal. We should take it while we can because who knows what's going on with the economy, and is it worth the risk, to enter restricted free agency next year? Is there really going to be a better deal than that on the table? Do you think that's a fair read of the situation?
Yeah, I think so. I kind of suspect that probably what happened is the two sides had their positions, they kind of staked out, and they probably weren't a whole lot apart, maybe, something like 5 to 10 million over the life of the contract. And, when the deadline serves is kind of a pressure to get these deals done. You know, most extensions, the max ones, tend to happen in the latter stages of training camp or even into the start of the regular season. You know, I think Martell Webster's extension last year got done right before the home opener and after Chargers had already played a game on the deadline on Halloween night. So, you know, I think that's fairly common. And, yeah, I mean, I think from LaMarcus's perspective, you know, there's a chance that maybe if you have a great season, you can go out and get a little bit more next summer in free agency. But there's also a chance that you, if you have kind of a disappointing season, if you have injuries or something like that, that, you know, there's so many free agents on the market next summer that you could kind of slide into even that third tier. You know, he's definitely not going to be in that first tier because that's going to be the LeBron, Wade, you know, Bosch, Stoudemire, those guys. But maybe, you know, he hoped probably he went to free agency to be in that second tier. But there's a chance of slipping down to the third tier. So, you know, both sides are taking a risk when you have an extension like this, but I think both of them thought it was worthwhile.
So it was pretty interesting talking to Nate today as well. I asked Nate, you know, did you have any message for LaMarcus? I think that Nate, he gets a lot of press for how much he talks to Brandon in that conversation, that relationship, gets a lot of publicity. And I think, you know, he probably had a pretty full message for Brandon, you know, in terms of when his deal got done. But again, by contrast here with LaMarcus, Nate said that his only direct statement to LaMarcus was congratulations. And it was a pretty quick thing. And I think Nate also said he was pretty relieved to have it in the rear view. He was happy the organization was able to get it done, that they're past that, and he's ready to move on to the regular season. I think the timing there was, you know, perfect from Nate McMillan's perspective. But I thought that was interesting. It's almost like Brandon really is getting the bulk of the pressure, the bulk of the responsibility, the bulk of the expectations that go with that max contract. And LaMarcus is almost getting off a little bit scot-free here, sliding under. Even though he's getting paid this huge contract, it doesn't seem like the bullseye is on his back like it is for Brandon. Agree, disagree?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, it's the old line to the Spider-Man, to those whom much is given, much is expected. And Brandon Roy falls into that category right now. I mean, I think the other part of it is just simple timing. You know, in the off season, you can devote some time to, hey, Brandon, here's what I want you to work on now that we've got this deal done. You know, it's October, I don't know what day it is, 23rd. You know, they've already been doing this in training camp. Whatever they wanted him to work on, he's already worked on or he hasn't. You know, and they've got to be focusing on four nights away playing the Houston Rockets and actually playing a game. So bigger things at play right now. You know, the one question I had, and I don't know, the fact that there hasn't been much talk of it kind of implies the answer to me, but, I mean, did you see the fact that the extension wasn't resolved affecting LaMarcus at all during training camp?
You know, LaMarcus is the kind of guy, he's very difficult to read his emotions. He's very reserved. He's very quiet. I think, I'm not sure if it was actually the negotiations that affected him or if it was just a constant question that might have affected him. My guess is it was probably the second because he's getting asked every single day at practice, after games, where's the deal at? How do you feel? You know, is it going to get done? Are you feeling positive? And he really took a hands-off approach and just let his agent deal with it. And I think that was really the best decision for LaMarcus to make, but still at the same time. So I don't think he was even really necessarily directly involved in those negotiations very often, if at all. But it seemed like the grind of all the questions was starting to get to him. I mean, he's a very shy guy. Even at his press conference today, just his mannerisms. He's got his hand covering his face at different parts. He's always looking down. He doesn't really like all the cameras. He's not really making eye contact with people who are asking questions. He doesn't do the sort of polished things that Brandon does or the other people who are a little bit more media savvy do. So I don't think it was necessarily the negotiations, but it was all the mess that goes around with it that might have gotten to him a little bit. But he played pretty well in the preseason. I mean, he didn't play horrible. He didn't play over his head, but he kind of did what he does. He had a bunch of games where, you know, his shot's falling, so he gets almost 20 points, and he – you know, gets his, you know, 6 to 10 rebounds, and that's kind of what LaMarcus is. So I don't know if it really got to him that much. There wasn't really any outside indicators of immense stress, you know, let's put it that way. But what, here's another interesting that, thing that Nate said. I asked Nate, okay, so what's next for LaMarcus, right? What do you want to see LaMarcus do to improve his game? What do you think Nate said?
Get to the free throw line more?
Well, that was one thing. He said everything. He said across the board, LaMarcus needs to improve. He said defense needs to improve. Defensive rebounding needs to improve. Offensive rebounding needs to improve. His offense needs to improve. Getting to the basket needs to improve. Everything. There wasn't a single thing that Nate thought that LaMarcus couldn't improve on. And, again, a little bit of a contrast between how he treats LaMarcus and how he treats Brandon. I don't think you're ever going to hear Nate go out of his way to kind of, you know, challenge Brandon to take another step. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's more specific things in Brandon's case. And, I mean, I think that's fair because he's reached that all-star level, whereas, you know, LaMarcus is still looking to establish himself as that kind of a player.
It's really interesting. I think LaMarcus signing this deal was the smartest thing LaMarcus could have done because I'm telling you right now, Grego is about to come on in a big way. And by this time next year, we're going to be talking about how the offense is running through Greg Oden and Brandon Roy, obviously, still. But it's going to be B-Roy and Greg Oden. Those are going to be your top two options. And so LaMarcus getting paid at this point, perfect for LaMarcus. And I'm happy for him. You got to be happy for him. Any guy who shows up to his press conference in an XXXXL white T-shirt and just says, yeah, basically I'm signing for $65 million. No, I didn't even bother to wear a collar. I'm cool with it, whatever. You got to kind of like a guy like that. That's a great personality.
Yeah, I mean, good for him, you know. And this is something that the Blazers organization knew they ultimately had to get done to not have, you know, that concern about keeping the core of the team together, you know, over the course of the season and into next summer. You know, you weren't going to have cap space either way, so there was no real upside to leaving LaMarcus unsigned unless you thought that he was going to play poorly and end up taking less money. So, good news all around.
And you know who was very jovial? Kevin Pritchard. He was in his pink shirt. You know, he's always in a good mood when he has the pink shirt on. It's always good news if he has the pink shirt on. He was almost giggly afterwards. He was joking. I think he feels like his summer or his off season is officially complete now. It's not like he gets to have a real break because he's obviously got a bunch of other things he's got to worry about, but his focus now gets to change from dealing with messy paperwork situations to more of the on-court stuff, and I think that's what really drives KP. I think that's, you know, what he wants his focus to be. I'm not sure how much he likes the whole negotiating and, you know, that whole process. I think he likes to watch the team on the court just like everybody else.
So is it fair to say then that KP's golden aura is back?
Oh, without question. Well, if you're in a pink shirt, can you have a golden aura? I guess that's the real question. But if you can, KP's got the golden aura with the pink shirt. Maybe a fuchsia aura? Is that, is there any overlap there? Slang in my white tee, I bang in my white tee. All in the club, spin game in my white tee. I bling in my white, serve fiends in my white tee. Fuck up, throw back, I look clean in my white tee. I slang in my white tee, I bang in my white tee. All in the club, spin game in my white tee. I bling in my white, serve fiends in my white tee. Fuck up, throw back, I look clean in my white tee. All right, KP2, we're back. It's time to talk about one of my favorite stories of the summer, a story that you've regularly mocked. You can't understand why it's a story that had to be a story, and that's the story of the 15th man on the Blazers roster, Patty Mills, Australian point guard by way of St. Mary's University, gets the nod officially over Ime Udoka, hometown boy, and Jay Collins, the Wingcast favorite, for that 15th spot. This is kind of a shake your head signing, you know, a shrug your shoulders, what happened here signing. Thoughts?
Well, you know, I do think it probably got a little more coverage than it deserved. You know, I don't really think that the TV stations needed around-the-clock coverage from outside the Blazers training facility. You know, as the debate between Ime and Jaren Collins and Patty Mills came down to the final hours and finally reached its stunning conclusion, because it is the 15th guy on the roster. You know, it surprised me when they signed Patty Mills, when he accepted the tender. You know, we were trying to figure out how exactly that worked. I mean, I know the rule as far as, you know, that you have to extend a tender to keep the player's rights and that they have the choice of accepting it, even if you tell them they're not going to make the team which would make them eventually a free agent and maybe give them a chance to go to a different scenario that's better for them down the road. But, you know, the fact that Patty Mills is injured is such an unusual complexity to this whole situation that I think it's part of it. You know, if he had been out there on the court and in camp every day battling for a spot like Udoka were, I think this decision might seem somewhat different to people, as opposed to this is clearly such a move made, A, for the future, and B, for financial reasons in terms of the fact that he has a lower salary than those guys. So, yeah, I mean, I take it you were as surprised as I was.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. There's two reasons I see for the signing. Number one is, you know, the Blazers are all about asset collection, and they don't ever want an asset to go away for free. They don't ever want to lose something that they feel has value or has future value. So what would have happened had they signed either Collins or Udoka is you're basically saying goodbye, Patty Mills, a potentially valuable asset, even though he was taken so low at 55. But let's keep in mind, he was taken at 55 only because of that injury. A lot of people saw him, even on draft day, as a potential late first-round pick. People had him even higher than that when he was healthy earlier in that season. So the Blazers didn't feel like they really got a steal at 55, and they're patient. Obviously, they can wait for these guys. They've shown they can wait for players for years and years and years, whether it's Rudy, whether it's these guys they have over in Europe currently. So obviously, it really would have gone against what they've laid out as one of their key principles, which is collect assets and cash them in when they're ready to go. Had they just waived or let him go, that would have gone against, you know, an established pattern they've got out there. So in hindsight, it makes sense they would have him. But obviously, you know, the second reason is, as you mentioned, there's financial benefit to keeping him. They're going to save something like $367,000, and they'll be that much more under the cap than they would have been by signing one of the veterans. That gives them roughly $1.4 million of free cap space to facilitate a trade. I think a lot of people, although no one has said this within the organization, a lot of close observers believe there will be a trade coming before the trade deadline. Everybody thinks that every year. But, you know, this year it could happen as much as any other year just because of the need to consolidate, the existence of expiring contracts, the desire to really make a serious playoff push this year. A lot of factors are coming together that would suggest that maybe they would try to make a trade by the deadline. So every dollar counts when it comes to that in terms of being under the cap and being able to facilitate that trade. Like you mentioned earlier, this is going to be the last year they're really going to be able to do such a thing before they start maxing guys out and being over the cap. So that $367,000 could come into play, no question about it. Obviously, another factor weighing in is the fact that Collins and Udoka, frankly, during the preseason games that I watched, didn't really distinguish themselves. Ime looked slow. He looked really slow on defense. He was able to get some points, you know, kind of garbage buckets here and there, but that's not really what they want from him. He didn't show the ability to really stroke a three-pointer from the corner. He didn't really show a lot of trust in his shot. He was hesitant. A couple times he actually led to 24-second shot clock violations because he didn't want to pull up and take a shot. He didn't really show much cohesion with any of the players that he could potentially be playing with on that second unit. And Collins, frankly, just got bodied all over the court. I mean, he was just being pushed around by everybody. I mean, the Jazz were taking it right to him, and they know him better than anyone. So they obviously realized that he was a weakness, and they looked to actively exploit him when he was on the court. I think that did definitely weigh in to the decision. If one of those two guys had played really lights out, played great throughout the preseason, really stepped up like maybe Juwan Howard did during the preseason, then it maybe would have been a decision that went a different way. But the Blazers had all sorts of reasons they could go with Mills. And I do think it is a little bit cold-blooded that the Blazers kept both Udoka and Collins around for so long, given the direction they ended up going. I'm not sure if that was because Nate wanted to give them a full chance or what, but they really let those two guys kind of hang in the breeze by waiting so long to make up their mind.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know exactly when the Blazers kind of knew for sure that Patty Mills was going to try to make the team and was going to be part of the roster during camp. You know, I mean, that I think he signed the tender last Friday, was that right? And I believe that it was last Thursday was the deadline for them to offer him that contract.
Yeah, they pushed up right against the deadline. It was the last day. On Friday, they announced the signing, and that was the deadline, as far as I know, for them to offer their rookie the deal.
Yeah, so I mean, if it was a case where, they were trying to persuade Mills to go overseas, which I think everyone agrees would have been the best result for the Blazers, having him be an asset over there and not coming into the salary cap, even like the first round picks, Kluivert and Joel Freeland and Kaponin do. So that's what makes it even better if he's overseas. So, that's surely what they were trying to talk him into and telling him that maybe he wouldn't make the team or, that he wouldn't have a chance to play certainly this year, those sorts of things. And it was only when he decided that, absolutely, I do want to try and make the team and I don't want to play in Europe, that they had to finally decide, well, is that going to be worth it keeping him as opposed to keeping one of these two veteran guys? So I think from that standpoint, I can understand why the decision came when it did. And, it did come a few days before the final roster deadline, which is not until next. I think you have to cut guys on Saturday, probably, so that they've cleared waivers by Monday, which is the deadline to get down to 15 players. And, it doesn't sound like it's really stopped interest in them because you've got, talk that Jaren Collins might be headed to Phoenix. Udoka supposedly talking to two or three different teams. I know, I don't know how much this means, but David Locke, the Jazz broadcaster and a friend of mine, has been inquiring on Twitter about what Udoka has left because they're in a pretty desperate situation on the wings with Kyle Korver and CJ Miles being injured right now. But the fact that those guys didn't contribute a lot in the preseason isn't really unexpected to me. That fits where they've been. In Udoka's case last year, he was much more effective his first year in San Antonio, and then obviously his last stint in Portland was the best year of his NBA career. And then with Collins, it's been gradually over a period of several years, he's gotten to the point where even the Jazz stopped playing him, and they were the team that liked him the most in the league. So, that's a bad sign. With those two guys, I think more than anything, you're talking about losing veteran leadership. If you're getting to a point where you're having to play the 15th guy on the roster, as I've pointed out several times, you're going to be in trouble no matter who it is. It's not like there's a good way to fill the 15th man on the roster. It's just the better way. So I think the real question is how much on a young team did you need the leadership that Collins and Udoka offered?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, they've got Juwan Howard, who seems to be taking a very active leadership role. They've got the great veteran leadership of Andre Miller, who doesn't seem to talk to anyone on this team. No, just kidding. Just kidding. He's obviously a veteran presence. But I really think this team is Brandon Roy and LaMarcus Aldridge's team, And these guys are professionals. They handle themselves like professionals. They've been around now, They've gone on to their fourth year. Roy's been to an All-Star game. Aldridge has the potential to go to one. They've been to the playoffs. I mean, it could help, sure, but they've got some pretty good leaders right there. I would follow Brandon Roy into war, I just from watching him, how he carries himself, how he handles things, I'm not sure you need much more of a leader than that. He's one of the top leaders in the league, so that's
And
where I come out on that.
ultimately, I think there's only so much leadership that you can get from the 14th and 15th guys on your roster. Ultimately, it's got to be, your best players who take that leadership responsibility. And given that Brandon in particular has shown an inclination to take that on his own shoulders, it's not like you're forcing him into that role, then yeah. What about Collins' relationship? Did you see him help Greg Oden at all? Given that they've got kind of a different, the fact that they're both centers, a different relationship than maybe he can have with Brandon or LaMarcus.
Well, Nate actually pointed that out, that they were working in the video room together after practice one day. So we were able to actually, view that happening. Collins is obviously a really smart guy. I think Greg is a pretty smart guy too. He's pretty cerebral. He understands the game. He doesn't always necessarily do at this point what he probably knows he should be doing, but I think that more often than not, Greg knows where he needs to be, what he should be doing, and he's obviously a very coachable player, responds really well to coaching. So there was some benefit there with Collins, but they've got two pretty darn good coaches working with Greg in Baino and also Lucas. I think Lucas probably provides as much, of that mentoring role that they might expect from Collins. Do you really need to have another voice telling Greg what to do? At some point, I wonder if you're babying Greg, I mean, do you need to have five guys looking over his shoulder all the time? He's poised to, average a double-double. How many mentors does this guy need? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think based on the way he's played in the preseason that right now, I don't think you need to worry about Greg in any sense of the word. He's established that he's ready to have a breakout season.
Enemies plotting my death. All 50 seeing visions of me shot in the chest. Couldn't rest, nah, nigga, I was stressed. Had me creeping round corners, homie sleeping in my vest. Shit, I'm like a hostage on this trouble block. Call the cops, a thug nigga screaming west side. Busting double glocks, hitting corners in my Chevy Suburban. Liquor got me driving up on the curb, hand on the steering wheel. Swerving, bless me, father, I'm a sinner. I'm living in hell, just let me live on these streets. Cause ain't no peace for me in jail. Getting worldwide exposure with a bunch of niggas that don't give a fuck. Riding as my soldiers, I'm just releasing on the warpath. Not your average dealer, west side outlaw, bad boy killer. Complete my mission, my competition, no longer beefing. I murdered all them busters, now I'm the last motherfucker streets. A buster free, enemies give me reason to be the last motherfucker breathing. Busting my automatic rounds, catch them while they sleeping. Now I'm the last motherfucker breathing.
So on that subject of Greg Oden, he was unofficially, but let's just go ahead and call it officially, named to the Blazers starting lineup. He will be the one out of the five positions that does turn over from the end of last season. I think his play this preseason has been the number one highlight of the entire preseason, and by a good distance. He definitely outplayed Prisbilla. They saw a similar playing time. Greg got a few more starts than, you know, we might have expected coming into the preseason, and he definitely was extremely effective in the minutes that he did play. So he will be starting alongside Aldridge up front. Batum will stay at the three. Brandon will stay at the two. And in the somewhat surprising but not super surprising final decision, it looks like McMillan will go with Steve Blake over Andre Miller at that one spot. Now, I know you read my piece about McMillan's thought process, you know, roughly a week or so ago about maybe some of the history as a Sonic that might have influenced his decision to stick with Steve over Andre. First of all, can you go ahead and compliment me on how great that piece was? And then second, can you maybe tell us a little bit about your reaction to it?
Well, you foresaw the future there in terms of what Nate's decision-making was looking like. So I have to give you credit there. But, you know, as we were going over last night in one of our frequent conversations, if you read in the Pro Basketball Prospectus 2009-10, there's a section in there about how Andre Miller might be a better fit for the Blazers as a backup. And I can't take credit for originating that idea. Certainly, you know, it'd come up on Blazers Edge before, but you know, given my concerns about the Miller signing and how he fit in with Brandon Roy and everybody else in the lineup, you know, I kind of took to that immediately, and I haven't really been surprised by what's happened so far. You know, the fact that Roy and Miller have had kind of this uneasy coexistence in the backcourt when they've been playing together, you know, is kind of predictable given the nature of Brandon's game and the nature of Andre's game. I mean, I've been a little surprised by, you know, we've talked about this in the past, but the fact that Miller has kind of not been welcomed with open arms in Portland. There's been kind of this maybe reluctance to completely embrace him, not only by the fans, but even by, you know, his teammates and the coaching staff, maybe, which, you know, at least publicly is a bit of a surprise. But, you know, I just because it's a starting lineup on opening night doesn't mean it's going to be the starting lineup for all 82 games, because if Brandon and Andre are going to play together in the backcourt, and that's going to, every minute they spend doing that, they're going to get a little bit better at it. They're going to understand each other's strengths and weaknesses the way that Blake and Roy do from having just played together for so long at this point. You know, that there's an experience factor to it.
Well, we definitely need to make clear that Andre did not have a good preseason. I mean, he put up points and he had some nice assist totals in a few games, but overall, when he started, he was 0-2. When Blake started, he was 4-2. The team didn't necessarily look in sync that often when Roy and Miller did play together. So not only do you have sort of like the, you know, the theory behind, you know, does Brandon need the ball? Does Andre need the ball? Can they coexist? Is it going to be a process that takes a while? But you also had, you know, in practice evidence that, hey, this thing isn't ready to go quite yet. If these games start counting come Tuesday, are we ready to go a different direction? I don't think Nate McMillan could look himself in the mirror and say, hey, we are ready to go there. You know, every win, every single game is magnified in Portland because we've got nothing else to do. Every game is important. Nate takes every game very seriously. He's very proud of that 54-win team from last year. He's not going to let the team, you know, toss away the first 2 weeks of the season as they get Andre acclimated. You know, he doesn't want to sort of trial by fire here. He wants to make sure he's ready to go opening night, day one, they want to beat the pants off the Rockets on Tuesday, no question about it. And if that's your strategy, you pretty much have to default to Blake. And I can kind of see where Nate finally came to that conclusion. It makes sense. But long-term, my big concern with Andre backing up right now is that in the minutes he did play in a backup role during the preseason, he completely dominated the ball. He didn't necessarily trust his teammates in that second unit that much. Part of that's because Rudy, I think, was injured. But when you have Andre out there with Martell Webster, Travis Outlaw, and Joel Prisbilla, who do you think is taking all those shots? When Andre's looking around, surveying the court, he's thinking, Andre, I'm the best option. He's taking the ball to the basket. He's forcing things. He's really looking to keep the ball in his hands even more than he might in the starting lineup. And long-term, I'm a little bit worried about that second unit because, you know, those guys kind of – like Travis succeeded last year because he had the ball in his hands a lot. I think his touches go down. Joel was in the starting lineup, so he didn't need touches. They didn't really expect anything from him offensively. When he goes to that second unit, you know, is he going to be as effective as he was in the first unit? I'm not sure. So I think there's still a lot of questions about how the second unit works together. And I think the biggest question of all is Rudy's health, because I think Rudy can help push the tempo along with Andre. If he's not in there, things could get ugly in those second and early fourth quarters.
Well, it's odd that we're saying this about a team that, you know, retains so many parts from last season, but, you know, the Blazers needed to keep Rudy healthy. Where it was a problem is that he didn't get a chance to be out there with Miller and, again, build that kind of cohesion and chemistry out there on the court, you know, because he missed so much of the preseason. So that's going to be something that's going to have to be built on the fly when he gets back into the lineup. You know, I mean, I think to an extent, you know, Andre Miller might be right if he says that he's the best option on the court, especially without Fernandez, because, you know, he's shown that he can score as a starting point guard. Going up against second team ones, you know, he's even a better matchup and, you know, can exploit some of his skills, you know, his ability to post up a little bit and, you know, get to the basket. And I think that can help those other guys. You know, he can set up on Prisbilla at the rim better maybe than anybody in the starting lineup can. So that could be a positive. You know, I think that's going to come with time, and Nate McMillan's certainly going to be in his ear if he's shooting the ball too much. You know, that's not the way he wants his point guards to play.
No question about that. Hey, going back to that Nate article, did you kind of get a chuckle when you heard him talk about how he's still not over the fact that Gary Payton was named a starter almost 20 years later, and it's still stuck in his craw that the coaching staff announced Gary as a starter from day one, before he had proven anything, before Nate had a chance to defend his spot? Did that make you chuckle? Did that surprise you at all, or was that kind of in keeping with the character that you remember from Nate, you know, back with his days up in Seattle?
Yeah, I mean, that didn't surprise me. It was a chuckle. You know, what he often expounded about during his days as the Sonics head coach was his relationship with Bernie Bickerstaff, who was the head coach of the Sonics when he first came into the league as a rookie. And, you know, I think he gives Bernie a lot of credit for being willing to trust him and let him come in as a starter right away, and the team had a lot of success. But he's still a little bitter that Bernie basically instructed him as the point guard not to shoot. He told him, you know, so I just said that with Miller as far as toning down his shot attempts, but, you know, he's reluctant to ever tell a guy not to shoot, specifically because of that own his own experience as a player and how frustrated he was by the fact that he didn't have the opportunity to develop his scoring game. You know, and again, something that I think in hindsight Nate would admit made a lot of sense at the time, because he was playing with three great scorers in Tom Chambers, Dale Ellis, Xavier McDaniel, who he also takes some pride in the fact that he was the guy delivering the basketball, and they all ended up scoring over 20 points a game that season. I think that, I don't know if anyone's gotten there since. I think Washington might have done it a couple of years ago. But, yeah, you know, Nate is a coach really, and I think this is true of everyone, but he really draws a lot on his experiences as a player. And oftentimes it's not just, you know, the guys that he really respected who were his coaches, George Karl in particular, you know, what he learned from them, but also kind of the what I learned what not to do from my own experiences and how I got coached. So that's kind of an interesting aspect of Nate, and he's not entirely shy about sharing that sometimes.
Man, it's funny to see a coach so clearly associate with a player that you wouldn't necessarily think that he might associate with. You know, you've got Steve Blake, who basically has one skill, shooting the ball and managing a game, but basically shooting the ball. And you've got, Coach Nate with, as a player, a different skill set, but obviously a similar focus in managing a game, running a team. And you can kind of tell that they've got a bond there between the two of them that is pretty tight and goes to some levels that you might not initially expect. Goes to some psychological levels. And had I heard Nate tell me what he told me in that one piece, had he told me that last year, I don't think I ever would have thought that Andre had a chance to start opening day. But having not heard that until after I had seen both Blake and Miller during the preseason, where Miller was by far the more talented player by the merits only, and being able to get sucked into the idea that, okay, well, you want to have your best players on the court together for the most amount of time generally as a basketball philosophy. Had I heard Nate's speech previous to that, I don't think I ever would have gone down that route. I wouldn't even consider it. I would just said Blake all day. And here we are, opening night on Tuesday, and it's going to be Steve Blake all day. Do you think he can make it through the entire series, or sorry, the entire season as a starter, or will eventually there be a switch?
Well, let me go to your point, because I think one thing I will say is I think that if you view it from that perspective that Miller never had a chance, ironically it sort of becomes flipped, and Miller is the Steve Bla is the Nate McMillan, I should say, in this situation, where he's the guy that the team didn't even give a chance to win the job. So that's why part of why I think Nate is hesitant to declare starters before camp or do anything like that. He wants to give guys a chance to play their way into that spot or play their way out of that spot. And I don't think it's just lip service in his case, and again, because of his own experience.
Oh
But,
yeah, to clarify, I totally agree with you. I guess what I was trying to say is, if I knew how deeply Nate took that experience of being the starter and having GP come in over the top of him and not have a true chance and not have the ability to hold his spot based on merits, if he had said that, then I would have basically just assumed that Blake would have been able to do what Nate had wanted to do. I don't think he just completely disregarded the idea of Andre as a starter. I do think he gave Andre a legitimate chance. But I think that we understand when push came to shove, what was the deciding factor for Nate? Was it talent, or was it comfort level and the association between him and Steve? And I think, if I had heard that speech in, the end of last year, I think I would have defaulted to the comfort level rather than the talent, which is where I was leaning before I heard Nate say what he said. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's fair. As far as maintaining it the whole season, I think part of it, a lot of it's going to depend on the success of the team. If the Blazers are going along and they're on a 55 plus win pace, even if Andre starts to play well, he starts to be more comfortable with Roy. He shows what he can do and that he's got a broader skill set than Blake, as we know he does. I don't think you're going to make that change midstream. Because there's going to be a hesitance to take that risk of screwing up the chemistry that you're building by making a change like that. So I think there's definitely a realistic chance that Blake starts the whole season, but I wouldn't be surprised to see Miller claim that job if he eventually starts to get that comfort level.
I'll tell you one thing. I don't admire the spot that Steve Blake is in right now because he's the less talented player on a team with ridiculously high expectations, with a very talented player breathing down his neck. So if anything goes wrong, who's going to be the whipping boy? From everybody, it's going to be Steve Blake. As much as we talk about this is Brandon Roy's team, this is LaMarcus Aldridge's team, Greg Oden's going to step up and have a big year. If anything goes wrong, if they get off to a slow start, if things aren't clicking, it's going to be all about Steve Blake being the unfair, quote unquote, starter over Andre Miller. And for that, I say, Steve Blake, bless your heart. Good luck. I hope the best for you. I hope the team gets off to the start that everyone expects, because otherwise you're going to be catching a lot of it. And that's a tough spot to be in. I don't envy Steve Blake at all at this point.
Do you see Blake as potentially, I mean, you know, bears the brunt of the criticism from fans this year, or do you see think someone else will?
What I'm saying is, if they get off to a slow start, it's going to be on Blake. Unless, Brandon is just looking absolutely horrible, or someone's really sticking out looking terrible, or there's injuries or some other crazy side story that will get the influence. But if you're a less strictly talented player and there's a more talented player behind you and the team isn't running well and you're not able to lead the team to victory at a position like point guard, I mean, you're the Fall Guy by default, you know? I mean, everybody has an opinion, but that's going to be the easiest opinion, the easiest shoot from the hip opinion of this season is if anything's not going right, it's Blake's fault. Every loss, it's Blake's fault. Because Blake's not going to put up the numbers. Blake's going to get lit up by elite point guards. We can just assume that's going to happen. I mean, Deron Williams drops 27 points on his face. Looks absolutely incredible. I mean, Steve Blake made Deron Williams look like an MVP candidate during that exhibition game. I'm dead serious. Deron Williams was so impressive. Deron Williams was leaps and bounds above Brandon Roy in that game. And I wrote that, and the Jazz fans, of course, loved it because, you know, Deron Williams hasn't got his credit. But Deron Williams looked like a stud. And there's one reason why he looked like a stud, because Blake couldn't do anything to stay in front of him. He just got bodied into the key. He got run right by, turned around in circles, falling down on the ground. It was not a good show. If it had been on TV, people would already be calling for Blake's head. So those kinds of things are really going to make Blake's life difficult. And like I said, I don't envy his position. I don't know who else would step up and be a whipping boy at this point. You know, Greg Oden's obviously another candidate, but he's playing so well. I think people are going to be very surprised and pleasantly so once they can actually watch him on TV. Greg's looking great, and he's playing with smiles. He's playing as a team player. You know, he's really in the flow of the game. I think people are going to love what they see from Greg. You know, even if there's losses, I don't think they're going to be pinning it on Greg necessarily. I think that's going to come back to Blake, and you know, obviously, that's what goes with being the starting point guard. You kind of have to deal with that, and I don't think Blake's necessarily going to let it get to him. But it will make for an interesting, you know, plot throughout the entire course of the season. I wouldn't be entirely surprised to see Andre starting, especially during the second half of the year. You know, I think ideally they would kind of like Andre to be maybe in that starting role during the playoffs because, you know, once push comes to shove in the playoffs, you have to have a better defensive point guard than Steve Blake. Hopefully Andre Miller is that guy once he's in shape, once he's ready to go, once he knows the systems and schemes. But we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the position to watch coming into training camp, other than maybe Oden's development, and nothing has changed yet. You know, it's still there.
For you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, I own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the arraignment killer.